that kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. Derek, let's start with Israel and Iran, and let's talk about Israel's planning for a retaliation for the Iran attack that we talked about a few days ago.
Yeah, so to briefly recap that attack, which came in response to the Israeli airstrike on the Iranian consular building in Damascus earlier this month that killed seven IRGC personnel and a number of other people, but the seven Iranians were the big target, I assume. The Iranians over the weekend launched a fairly substantial drone and missile strike in terms of just the number of projectiles that were employed. They fired over 300 drones and missiles at Israel. Most of them appear to have been intercepted. The ones that hit exclusively military targets. There were some injuries. There's one, I think, Bedouin Arab girl who is in critical condition. I'm not sure of her status at this point. But other than that, I'm not sure any of the injuries were particularly severe beyond that one. You know, I think you and I talked about this, and the consensus seems to be that this was meant to be more show than tell, in effect, that the Iranians were trying to send a message without using any hardware or targeting anything particularly sensitive that could trigger another escalation by the Israelis. Nevertheless, despite appeals from the U.S., from other Western countries, Germany, the U.K., a number of quarters asking the Israelis to just sort of take the win and not respond in kind, the Israeli government has decided it will retaliate.
Now, Israel has a range of options for that retaliation. Iran sent 350 or so missiles and drones. Israel could retaliate in kind with missiles of its own. Another possibility, a cyber attack, something else covert. I asked the chief spokesman of the Israeli military whether they were considering those more covert options. He would only say that Israel will respond at a time and in a manner of its choosing.
The only things I've seen out of Iran have been, you know, threats to retaliate more substantially next time, that, some massive response if the Israelis do attack. Some of that is, I think, you know, intimidation. It's not necessarily going to be the case that they would do anything. However, I think it was on Thursday, one of the generals in the IRGC did say that if the Israelis strike any Iranian nuclear sites, the Iranians may finally decide that they're no longer satisfied having a nuclear weapons capability, and they will decide to go for a nuclear weapon, an actual nuclear weapons program. So that, I think, is probably credible, and this is one of the things that sort of hangs over this back and forth, that if the Israelis and the U.S. push too hard in the wrong place, that the Iranians are going to just say, okay, we've been holding back from developing nuclear weapons, but we're going to go ahead and do it, which would still take several months. They have enough uranium for a handful of weapons, enough enriched uranium, but they don't have the technology. They haven't, it would be fairly obvious when they test a nuclear weapon if it comes to that. So they haven't done that, which means they're probably some ways away from having a weapon, but that is a risk here if things go the wrong way.
So I was listening to Josh Landis on Bob Wright's podcast, friend of our pod, Bob Wright, and he said that one of the effects of the successful, I guess, deterrence effort is that this has demonstrated to the region that the United States and Israel, but really the United States, is still militarily in charge. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that potential signal effect that this actually or bolsters the U.S. and Israel's position within the Middle East, which obviously took a hard blow after the October 7th, the success of the October 7th attack.
I didn't listen to this. Is he talking about the fact that they intercepted?
So many weapons. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know. I don't know that that's the case. For one thing, I think that they've exaggerated. There's been some reporting on this. They exaggerated the success of the interception mission. They still intercepted the vast majority of the missiles and drones, but they were talking about like 99% interception, which is ridiculous to think about. But in the immediate aftermath, it seems like it was more like 85 to 90% successful. So it wasn't as successful as they've been pretending that it was. And the fact of the matter is that we don't know how much the Iranians actually threw at them. The Iranians are saying that they used older weapons. They didn't use any of their modern, you know, more capable ballistic missiles, their hypersonic supposedly weapons, or any of their advanced hardware. Partly, I think, because they don't want to tip their hand and they want to save something for a potential, you know, escalation down the road. And partly, again, I think because they didn't intend for this response to do anything other than say, OK, we responded. We had our say here and let's all go home, which is what they said in the immediate aftermath of the attack. They said, we think this is from our perspective, this is done. It's over, but we'll retaliate if the Israelis do again. So I don't know that I buy that. I mean, I think for the Israelis, what you would hope is that the Israeli government, that Benjamin Netanyahu would take that message away, that that he would take the message that the U.S. is protecting Israel. Israel has nothing to worry about. It doesn't need to, quote unquote, restore deterrence. That not only the U.S., but these the Arab countries that participated or allegedly participated, a number of them aren't really talking about it for obvious reasons, but that there's this regional, you know, network of countries, Jordan being one of them, Saudi Arabia, perhaps Iraq, perhaps, we don't know. Again, they're not acknowledging it for obvious reasons, but that that all these countries are also invested in, at the very least, preventing a war between Israel and Iran. And so they will also step in to protect Israel if it comes to that. And so the idea would be to sort of convince the Israelis that they don't need to retaliate. But that has apparently failed, and we'll have to see to what extent they retaliate. But I think yeah, I just don't know that it restores in an objective sense, that it restores any sense of U.S. control here. It seems to me that the U.S. has had no control over anything, including its best good friend client state, especially its best good friend client state in the region for the past 6 months, if not longer.
Well, thank you, Derek. Why don't you let us know what's going on with the Rafah operation, which has been, you know, stalled or delayed or, I don't know, maybe even canceled for weeks. What's going on with that?
Yeah, it's not canceled. It's definitely not canceled. I think that, you know, again, they're probably going to wait until after whatever they do with Iran, and then they'll have to wait and see what the Iranians do in return and, you know, in response. Which is all kind of, you know, contingent on, I don't know, whatever timetable the Israelis are on. But they did meet, apparently, the Biden administration and Israeli officials had another one of their virtual meetings on Thursday to talk about Rafah. We don't know what they talked about or whether, you know, how it went, whether it went smoothly or not. Part of the discussion was certainly going to involve whatever arrangements the Israelis are pretending to make, at least to assuage fears about high levels of civilian casualties. There was a report that was picked up by the Times of Israel. It originated with an outlet called the New Arab, which has an English and an Arabic service. This was in their Arabic service, citing Egyptian officials this week who said that the Biden administration has basically already told the Israelis, and this is something I think I said on Sunday that I was afraid was going to happen, that the Biden administration has told the Israelis, you know, okay, fine, do whatever you want in Rafah, but in exchange, you know, we're not going to get on your backs about civilian casualties, et cetera. But in exchange, you have to have a light touch with whatever comes next with Iran. And so the Israelis have basically leveraged the threat of a bigger retaliation against Iran to get out from under whatever criticism they might be facing when the civilian casualty figures start to come in from Rafah. The administration has rejected or denied that report. And, you know, the sourcing is anonymous Egyptian officials. It's not great, but it certainly seems consistent with how the administration is conducting itself these days, sort of trading at the margins with the Israelis and begging them not to be excessive, and then having the Israelis say, you know, screw you, we're going to do what we want, and kind of picking at the edges, but not really exerting any real pressure.
Thanks, Sarek. Let's stay in the region and talk about the United States, which is still pursuing normalization with Saudi Arabia vis-a-vis Israel.
This is another crazy story. The Wall Street Journal reported this on Thursday that somewhat incredibly, the administration is going to make another pitch amid all that is going on in the Middle East. It's going to make another pitch to normalize relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia before the election. It still views this as some kind of big card that it can trumpet for the election for people who, I guess, are deeply invested in the idea of normalizing relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia, American voters who just can't get enough of that stuff. It's going to make another push, or is making another push. Apparently, according to the journal, the U.S. U.S. officials are using the fact that the Saudis participated in this defense of Israel over the weekend, which, again, the Saudis aren't openly acknowledging, but they're using this as sort of evidence to point to say to the Israelis, your security is better served by doing a deal with the Saudis that gives the Palestinians, that at least pays lip service to the idea of Palestinian statehood, than, you know, continuing on this intransigent path. The roadblock remains just the complete blanket opposition by the Israeli government to even the hint of kind of waving at the idea of Palestinian statehood. And according to the Wall Street Journal, the Saudis are willing, or maybe willing, to accept what they said were verbal assurances from Israel that it would engage in new talks on Palestinian statehood, which is nothing. I mean, that's literally accepting nothing for the Palestinians, because that's just vapor. But the Israelis won't even do that. And for domestic reasons, I can sort of understand why Netanyahu feels like right now would not be a good time for that. Politically, it wouldn't be a good time to start talking about Palestinian statehood or even make a mention of it. It would, you know, be a hard sell for his far right cabinet. But this is, you know, this has been the Israeli position all along. They won't trade one for the other. So I don't understand why the administration is still trying to beat its head against this brick wall. The Saudis, of course, don't care about Palestinian statehood. They don't care about really normalization with Israel that much, although it would probably have some economic benefits for them. What they care about is the fact that on the other side of that deal, they get a blanket security commitment from the U.S. They get help building a civilian nuclear power program that could, you know, maybe be weaponized someday. Who knows? Who's to say what might happen? So they get a lot of benefits from the U.S. out of this, and that's what they're really after. I don't know why the administration's continuing to pursue this.
What about the vetoing of Palestinian statehood?
Yes, this is another story that's been reported all week. The Palestinian Authority has reintroduced its statehood application at the United Nations, basically application for full membership, full state membership in the United Nations, which would be de facto recognition of a Palestinian state. The U.S. has reportedly, this is according to The Intercept, Ken Klippenstein and Daniel Bogoslaw reported on this earlier this week. The U.S. has been lobbying members of the UN Security Council, which has to recommend, it has to have a vote on a resolution for membership to recommend new members to the General Assembly before they can be admitted. It's been whipping votes against Palestinian statehood. And now the New York Times reported on Thursday that the administration is just going to veto. So apparently that effort to whip votes failed because they were trying to avoid having to cast their veto, but they are going to veto the measure. There was a report also earlier this week that they tried to bribe Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority, to withdraw the membership bid with their carrot was a White House meeting with Joe Biden, which sounds like a punishment to me, but you know, you may your mileage may vary, I guess. Needless to say, Abbas told them no, he was going to go ahead with the vote. It will fail, but it will put the U.S. on the spot for having had to cast its veto.
Let's talk about North Korea, where the U.S. is trying to create an independent sanctions monitor. What does that mean? What's going on?
Yes. Speaking of UN Security Council vetoes, I guess the UN has had for some time an expert committee, quote unquote, expert committee or expert panel, whose job is to monitor compliance with the UN's North Korean sanctions regime. That panel's mandate runs out at the end of this month. There was a vote in the Security Council in late March to extend the mandate for another year, and Russia vetoed it. So the panel will be out of rope effectively at the end of this month. So the U.S. is in discussions with the Japanese and South Korean governments to create its own separate, outside the bounds of the UN, expert panel that would purportedly monitor compliance with North Korean sanctions. The sanctions are still there. The sanctions aren't going anywhere. It's just this panel, this monitoring panel is going away. You know, the panel, whatever they create, is going to lack whatever legitimacy comes from being branded a UN body. It won't have any purchase, presumably outside the U.S. and its you know, its allies, its partners, and so I assume the U.S. will use it just as a sort of cudgel to wield against the North Koreans for violating sanctions, or against Russia for participating in sanctions violations. Maybe even China. Who knows? I mean, all the countries that sort of still trade with North Korea, kind of in violation of those sanctions, the U.S. will point to the findings of this panel to sort of air its grievances in that regard, but it's not going to have any real effect beyond that.
So, Derek, it turns out the Great Barrier Reef, it's not doing that great. Tell us about this bleaching that's been going on.
Yeah, we talked about this a week or two ago, that there have been concerns that another global mass coral bleaching event is underway, because ocean temperatures are so high, and when they get high enough, coral ejects the protective algae that forms on it, and it bleaches effectively. All the color goes away, and the coral themselves are then at great risk of dying off. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration confirmed earlier this week that we are experiencing another one of those global bleaching events. And then the Australian government on Wednesday said that in terms of the Great Barrier Reef, this is the worst bleaching event that they've ever seen.
The oceans are acting as this big heat sink. The problem is that capacity to absorb this heat is coming with drastic ecological ramifications. It's gotten to the point where we're seeing simultaneous coral bleaching events everywhere around the planet, essentially at the same time.
In general, the reef has gone from bleaching, you know, maybe once every few years, to bleaching pretty much every year. But this particular bleaching event is so severe that there's a lot of concern, I think, that the coral will not be able to recover, or, you know, in many areas it will not be able to recover. So, I mean, this is, you know, just sort of one of those incalculable losses in terms of biodiversity, in terms of, you know, the effects of climate change. And not that it's going to change anything, but probably worth noting.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at AmericanPrestigePod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Let's talk about Sudan, where the fighting that's been going on there has expanded into North Darfur.
Yes. The Darfur region, as we've talked about, is mostly under the control of the Rapid Support Forces group at this point. But the North Darfur, and specifically the capital of North Darfur, the city of El Fasher, has been relatively spared from a lot of heavy fighting. And as a result, it's become something of a haven for people displaced from other parts of the Darfur region. It's become a hub for humanitarian efforts coming across the border from Chad into the Darfur region. That's at risk now. There have been several days of fighting this week, apparently, between the RSF and the Sudanese military in El Fasher. This is some of the heaviest, I think maybe the heaviest fighting that's been recorded in that city since the start of their conflict. It's, you know, obviously a huge risk. There are hundreds of thousands of displaced persons in that city. As I said, it's become a humanitarian hub. So any degree of fighting, or if the RSF were to move in and take control of the place, would disrupt all of that. It would displace many of those people again. It would force relief agencies to pull out and try to find some other alternative, which there may not be one at this point in Darfur. So just a major concern to see fighting there.
Let's talk about Libya, where its UN envoy has quit. Why is that? What's going on?
Yes, the UN's envoy to try and set up a Libyan government at some point that's actually a unified national government, Abdoulaye Bathily, attended a Security Council meeting on Tuesday and apparently just let loose with his frustrations about the unwillingness of Libyan political factions to set aside some of their own interests and come together in a political process. He talked about the stubborn resistance of these factions, their indifference to the interests of the Libyan people, and just kind of blew up. And at the end, you know, after the meeting, he told reporters that he was resigning in frustration from his position as envoy. He's gotten nothing done because of the intransigence of these political factions. Libya is in stasis, basically. It was supposed to have elections in December 2021. They're just a bit overdue at this point. The factions had been able to make no progress toward an electoral law or changes to the constitution or adopting a new, you know, kind of rules governing the vote. And so they just blew through that deadline. They're back to a place. There's not constant fighting, but they're back to a place where there's effectively at least one government in eastern Libya and at least one government in western Libya. Those two factions are not really internally coherent either. So there's a lot of division within those two big groupings. And you know, as I say, there's a lot of, I think, intransigence and unwillingness to give up being, you know, king of a relatively small hill, you know, running one of these localized factions or one of these, you know, independent groups, that you would have to risk all the perks that come with that to participate in a real political process that could produce a unified government. And this just seems to be, on the part of the political elites, there seems to be a total unwillingness to do that. So that's where things stand. And I think Bathily's resignation is just kind of brought that out into the open for a little while this week.
Thank you, Derek. Why don't we talk about Niger?
Yeah, this is really interesting. The Washington Post, and I think this has been in a couple of other outlets, reported this week that there's a whistleblower within the U.S. Air Force who sent a complaint to Congress. And of course, people know that Niger's military government has asked the U.S. military to leave. It's canceled its military cooperation agreement with the U.S. It's been several weeks now since they issued that order, and the U.S. military has done nothing. Soldiers are still parked in Niger, and you know, the U.S. officials keep saying, "Well, we're trying to get clarification from the junta," like just playing dumb about it, I think. But the whistleblower's complaint said basically that officials in the U.S. embassy in Niger and Niamey are essentially lying to folks back home, back in the U.S. About the situation in Niger. They're trying to, it says they're trying to maintain the facade of a great country to country relationship. And they're just kind of covering up the ongoing evidence that the Nigerians want the U.S. out. And this is a real concern. I mean, these forces in Niger are potentially at risk if there's no agreement in place governing their status there. If the junta decides enough is enough, and you know, they probably wouldn't, because it's the United States and you don't want to needlessly antagonize the United States. But if they did, those forces would potentially be at some risk. There's an image problem, I think, for the U.S. to just sort of ignore this order and pretend that it doesn't have to follow what the government in place, and of course the U.S. doesn't necessarily recognize Niger's military government, but nevertheless it seems somewhat disrespectful what they're doing, and that could have impacts for the U.S. Image in Africa. That's another thing that the complaint talks about, potentially a negative effect on how other parts of Africa, other countries in Africa view the U.S. just kind of playing this game with the Nigerian government. So it's interesting. The U.S. U.S. officials in the Defense Department, I think in the State Department as well, have denied that they're sort of covering things up. They have acknowledged that they're trying to negotiate to maintain a military presence in Niger, and it's not going well. But they insist that they're not, kind of hiding anything from officials back in the U.S. So who knows what to make of that.
Thank you, Derek, as always. Why don't we now talk about Ukraine, where the U.S. has pushed back over oil refinery attacks undertaken by the Ukrainian military?
Yeah, John Hudson at the Washington Post reported on this this week. Kamala Harris, the vice president of the U.S., went to the Munich Security Conference back in February. She met with Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, and apparently one of the things she told him was that the Biden administration wanted Ukraine to stop attacking Russian oil refineries. She gave him a couple of reasons. One was the fear that this was going to antagonize the Russians into making a more violent attacks against Ukrainian civilian sites, power sites, whatever. But also she was concerned, and I guess the administration heading into an election is concerned, that these attacks might cause a spike in global oil prices, which would filter it down to the gas pump, and people don't like that, and it would be a big problem for the Biden administration. Zelensky apparently came away from this meeting quite irritated, because he and Ukrainian leaders, military leaders, and civilian political leaders feel like they're drone attacks, there have been a series of them against Russian oil refineries and other energy facilities, have been kind of one of the only things that they've had going for them for the last several months in this conflict. They have continued to attack oil refineries since that meeting, in I guess defiance of what the Biden administration has asked them to do. It's probably worth noting that none of these attacks seem to have had any real impact on Russian oil production. They certainly haven't impacted the war effort, which is part of the rationale behind them, that if you destroy or damage this oil infrastructure, that would trickle down to the Russian military's ability to wage war. There's no evidence that that's happening. There's also, while we're talking about the issue of U.S.-Ukrainian relations, there was a refrain coming from Kyiv all week, having watched the U.S. and company intercept all those Iranian drones and missiles. It was sort of like, why aren't you doing this for us? Like, why aren't you intercepting Russian drones and missiles when they're attacking Ukrainian cities? And of course, the situations are completely different. The risk would be completely different, orders of magnitude greater to get involved in downing Russian missiles. But you can sort of understand why they're kind of looking at this like, what do we have to do to get that same treatment? Now, to that end, part of the reason for this complaint is to up the pressure on the U.S. and other Western partners to start turning on the spigot again, because a lot of the military aid has dried up. that's left the Ukrainians struggling to maintain their air defense systems. They don't have enough ammunition. So, you know, more and more Russian missile strikes, drone strikes are getting through because there's simply not enough resistance to them. It does look like the U.S. House of Representatives is finally going to take up Joe Biden's supplemental military aid. It's going to do so a bit differently than the U.S. Senate. The Senate passed this omnibus war funding bill that Biden had submitted months ago. They've already passed that. It includes aid for Ukraine, for Israel, for Taiwan. I'm not sure all the other details, but it's all in one package. The House looks like it will consider these things in pieces. So it'll do a Ukraine bill, an Israel bill, a Taiwan bill. And I'm not sure if there's going to be anything else that comes out of that. It does maintain the top line figure in terms of military aid for Ukraine, around $61 billion. But it converts a portion of that aid, and I don't think this is the military aid, I think this is economic aid for the Ukrainian government, but it converts some portion of that aid to a loan. I think around $9 or $10 billion is converted to a loan, but it is a loan that the president would have the discretion to forgive, which means almost certainly it would be forgiven. So it's just kind of for show, I think, to assuage Republicans who are uneasy about continuing to provide open-ended grants to Ukraine in perpetuity. There's a lot of kind of backroom stuff going on with this. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, maybe, you know, his job may be at risk now because Republicans are mad that he's brought these things or going to bring these things to the floor. My sense is that they will pass. I don't have any particular insight into that, but I think with, you know, most Democrats on board and enough Republicans, these things will probably pass, and then presumably they'll pass the Senate as well, since the Senate's already said it's okay with this stuff. So I think maybe within a few days, Ukraine may have that spigot, as I said, may be turned back on to the tune of several billion dollars in new funding.
Thank you, Derek. Why don't we end now on Venezuela, because the United States has ended its oil and gas sanctions waiver.
Yeah, the State Department announced on Wednesday that it's not renewing the general waiver it issued back in October that raised or lifted sanctions on Venezuela's energy sector, oil and gas, basically. That waiver expired at midnight Wednesday, so it needed to be renewed. The administration announced it was not doing that. It has replaced the six-month waiver with a much more limited waiver that expires at the end of May, which is just meant to give companies that kind of took the bait and invested in projects in Venezuela under the waiver time to basically extract themselves from those operations without running afoul of U.S. sanctions. Basically, I mean, that waiver was issued as part of a deal where the administration was expecting the Venezuelan government to allow a quote unquote free and fair, by whatever U.S. standards, presidential election in July. Clearly, the administration is unsatisfied with how things are going there. The opposition, the joint opposition nominee to face incumbent Nicolas Maduro, Maria Corina Machado, is legally barred from running. She has been legally barred from running. She took the nomination anyway. There was, I guess, an expectation that Maduro's government would lift the ban and allow her to run, and they haven't. It hasn't done that. So it's unclear what the opposition is going to do actually for a candidate at this point. There have been reports from international human rights organizations, you know, warning about arbitrary arrests and you know, various other measures that the government is allegedly taking to suppress opposition. All of this kind of, I think, you know, just soured the administration, the Biden administration, on this whole project. And so it's now done away with the waiver. It says it will consider on a sort of case-by-case basis if companies want to apply to continue operating in Venezuela, but the general waiver is gone.
Thank you, Derek. And thank you, everyone, for listening. I also wanted to say I had a piece come out in Harper's Magazine. It's a cover story of their May issue on the financialization of Hollywood as well as conglomeration. So if you haven't yet, please check it out. And thank you all for listening. Bye.
Bye.